Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590, The Fan. Blake Murphy, J.D. Bunkus, filling in for Ailish Porfars, Justin Cuthbert. Give them a follow at J.D. Bunkus on Twitter, Instagram, at J.C. Cuthbert on Twitter, and some weird Instagram handle. I'd say keep those bet slips coming, but old trapdoor over here, me. Hopefully you guys are getting some bet slips otherwise. So we were talking about the MLB lockout at 6 o'clock.
Yeah. Serious exaggeration. Blake's having a tough day. He's like my. So here's the truth. Blake's a basketball guy, but his actual favorite sport is baseball. And that's a dirty little secret, but it is not a secret if you're...
I don't think it's a secret. Check the bylines.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, but I guess maybe not a secret, but something that you wouldn't assume because primarily Blake is a basketball writer now. But no, his roots are in baseball. Baseball's his favorite sport. He loses.
I mean, my roots are actually in
hockey.
He loses
us to Wake and
Rake. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
but either way, just that, you know, I could tell how crushed, you know, Blake is today. It's just that was a real sigh of, what am I supposed to... You know, that was Eeyore. I think he always lost his tail. He's like, oh, sigh. That was you. That's every one of us today that likes baseball, but you especially because of the bet loss.
I do have... Like, I did try to protect myself, too, where, like, we talked about yesterday. We were like, oh, what are the odds? What are the odds that doesn't get done? And I was like, ooh, I don't know. I think you guys would be a little too optimistic.
No, let's not bring that up.
Yeah, let's not bring that up. I was still too optimistic. Ending the lockout of he didn't answer his phone the first time we called him. Joining us now, Ben Nicholson-Smith, Sportsnet MLB editor, co-host of the At the Letters podcast. Ben, we just had you on 2 days ago, and it was a slightly more optimistic tune than it is today. How you doing, pal?
I'm doing okay. I mean, yeah, it's pretty devastating, I think, for baseball fans, for anyone who loves baseball. I think also, like, there's so many layers to this, right? Like, even if we were talking about the Cincinnati Reds or the Orioles, this sucks. It undermines the credibility of the top officials in Major League Baseball because they said this was a defensive lockout. Rob Manfred now is even harder to believe. But we're not talking about the Orioles here or the Diamondbacks. We're talking about a team that's barely played in its home city for 2 years now, and they happen to be one of the best teams in baseball. So it's devastating. And, yeah, I feel for Jays fans, and it really is a missed opportunity.
So are we rubes or what? Like, we clearly we bit on the pump fake. This was DeMar. You've seen him enough times that you know better, you know better, you know better, and then it comes down to this deadline, it gets slightly extended, and we're all leaping out trying to block the shot, and nope, foul, you bit. Are we idiots, Ben?
I don't think so. I mean, if we're idiots, then there are a lot of idiots in Major League Baseball.
Oh, sorry, I meant JD, Justin, and I. You're obviously not an idiot.
Yeah, no offense taken. I don't think anyone is. I don't think that it's unreasonable to be hopeful because, you know, and even now, I mean, they've canceled six games. They're not going to miss. I refuse to believe they're going to miss the whole season. They need each other. There will be an agreement at some point. Six games still is too many. Six games are unacceptable to miss, in my opinion. It's not okay. So, you know, I don't think that anyone's an idiot for being hopeful or for listening to those people who were hopeful, because those signs were coming from the leaders in charge. You know, the people that I was talking to at the highest levels were hopeful that there was going to be a deal, or at least that's what was being expressed. So I don't think anyone is so rude for getting on that, getting alongside with that.
So we got suckered in because the narrative heading into yesterday when they had the meeting number 14, right, was, hey, the owners are finally starting to be reasonable. They're starting to budge. And when we talked to you 2 days ago, it was, you know, they went up a percent, and it was pretty much no. These guys are going to try to break these dudes, and they're going to do that at all costs, and it's going to cause a work stoppage. And that's when we were pessimistic. And then it changes with the 14 meetings because we go, owners are doing something. And then it seems to me anyways like that was just a tactic by ownership and by Manfred to try to curry public favor or to once again try and trash their baseball players, like the actual stars of their sport, by saying we made some concessions. And then these guys, quote unquote, changed the tone. They changed the tone, and now the negotiations are completely different. We were trying to come to the table with all these reasonable things and acquiesce their demands. And then all of a sudden we were blindsided at the 11th hour right before our deadline and we're completely unprepared. Oh, actually, we have the rollout ready for the cancellation of the season media conferences. We've got all this stuff ready to go. And it appears that maybe this was the plan all along.
Well, you know, that's interesting, JD, because a lot of players feel that way. People that I've spoken to on the player side feel that way. And Major League Baseball cares a lot about public opinion. They were working hard to curry favor publicly. The players care, too. I mean, there's no doubt PR matters here. But Major League Baseball cares a lot. And the interesting thing is, if that was the strategy, and I don't know exactly what was going through Rob Manfred's head, but if that was the strategy, then almost would have worked, except for things are so much different now than they were in 94, 95, the last time a work stoppage led to missed games, in the sense that players, including Alex Wood of the Giants and many others, come out directly and say, we see right through this, Major League Baseball. We see what you're doing. We know that you're trying to win favor in the court of public opinion. And guess what? It's not going to work because the players have voices too. So if that was the strategy, I don't think it's going to land.
Ben, to localize this just a little bit, you also talked to you and Shai Davidi at Sportsnet.ca, talked to Ross Stripling for a piece that went up yesterday at Sportsnet.ca with games now lost, baseball in limbo as both sides determine next steps. And Ross Stripling is the Jays MLBPA rep. So some insight from him that, you know, this was close. This was far enough away that he wasn't entirely optimistic, but it was close enough that he had like made arrangements for spring training and started his ramp up for the regular season. Why did it feel so inconsistent in terms of the actual proximity to a deal here? Is this just like MLB was trying to control the message and they were overly liberal with how close it was? Or was there like, is there a deeper disconnect that the owners actually thought it was close and the players are like, what the heck? Like, is this PR distance or is this a reality in the owners didn't realize just how far away things were still?
I think there would have been people on the owner's side who knew that there was distance. And there would have been people on the owner's side who, despite that information, wanted the public perception to be that there was momentum. And look, there was momentum. I mean, Monday was by far the biggest day of talks. It was a very constructive day. They covered a lot of ground. So it's not inaccurate to say that there was momentum. Now, does that paint the full picture? Does that mean that the sides were actually close? No. And, you know, ultimately, Major League Baseball that day moved to 220 on the CBT. So, okay, that's progress. They were 210 this past season. But, you know, you start to look at how much they moved the CBT, and I know we're starting to get granular here, but if you look at the rate that was going to increase under Major League Baseball's proposal, it was under the rate of inflation. Like, it would have been 1.84%, I think is the number. And so it just wasn't hard. Again, talking to Ross Stripling yesterday, he's like, it just wasn't that hard of a decision because you look at revenues in Major League Baseball, and I know the last couple of years have been difficult, but it's still a $10-plus billion industry where revenues go up way more than 1-plus percent.
Yeah, I keep going back and forth on this because you mentioned the granular, and I go, no, it's not too granular because we all understand this. If you're paying attention, the owners are trying to screw the players here. This is as much of a no, there's not two sides to this as there's ever been. Even during the pandemic, I was pretty harsh on the players, right? Like when they were trying to figure this out, I thought the players were being a little short-sighted in terms of the way they were negotiating. And now I'm kind of looking at this and saying, wow, I take some things back. Maybe I was just being a little addedly frustrated with guys like Ryan Zimmerman who were complaining about team dinners as we were trying to find our way through the middle of a pandemic, or Kevin Pillar saying he needed to feed his family, whatever. But at the core of this, I do wonder, when we say, hey, Major League Baseball, have they controlled the message? Like, I know this is kind of a hard one for you to quantify, but if you're outside of our little insular bubble, right, guys who are reading multiple articles, guys like you who are reporters of the sport, guys like Blake who can actually understand the CBA down to the like final detail, do you think the public actually has a grasp of this, or do you think that there is just like indifference? Where do you think that the public is on this?
Oh, man, it's a good question. My public, the people who who kind of appear in my mentions are very, very savvy, very knowledgeable. I know that there are a ton of baseball fans and sports fans out there that are very knowledgeable. I also know there are people who tune this out, and that's totally fair. I think, you know, the understanding of the nuances of collective bargaining has definitely increased. I think that there's a lot of information out there. I think that if you're a fan who has any interest in this stuff, there's just a ton of resources out there that weren't around in 94, 95 when this happened for the last time. So I think that there's a lot of ways that fans can really understand this stuff pretty clearly. Unfortunately, it's not the reason we become sports fans, but yeah, I think fans know what the CBT is. It's a soft cap. I mean, we've seen caps. Baseball has a soft cap. That's what Max Scherzer was saying, and a lot of people in the baseball industry would agree with him.
So I guess the reason why I asked that, though, is because you said that baseball cares about public perception. And the real, I guess, chit that all of us would have that are living in this like idealistic world where the owners sacrifice something or that they're willing to come back to the table and be reasonable is that we always thought, okay, well, these guys are stewards of the game. They're supposed to care about the game. Eventually, they're going to care about that. No, that's already proven not to be true. Well, they're going to care about not killing a $10 billion golden goose and not hurting that product and not damaging it too much. Well, we saw that they made profits during a pandemic. They're going to make profits now. Nope, that's not true. I guess there would be some part of it where you would say, well, there are still owners that aren't corporations, that are actually faces of this thing, and that public pressure and public anger would actually be some kind of a force in terms of creating a little bit more urgency to get the baseball season going. Like, if you are someone who is a pillar in your community and is a face of your city, a lot of owners do this because they want to be loved, right? They want to stand there and get the commissioner's trophy and stand there and be looked at as a civic leader. Do you believe that that actual pressure could manifest into anything here? Like, when you say that they care about delivering the message, if it has been delivered poorly, is that a win for baseball fans potentially? Like, I'm just trying to find some piece of optimism here.
Yeah, I don't know if I view that as a possible avenue for fans. Like, I would love to believe that owners do this because they want to be loved, and I'm sure there's an aspect of that. I think a lot of the time, like, Major League Baseball is a great industry. Like, it's if you've got that kind of money, and not a lot of people do, it's a legal monopoly, right? There's an antitrust exemption. So it's very profitable. I know there's talk of, you know, the relative importance of baseball diminishing, and that's true, but it still is a $10 billion industry. So we're talking finances here, and I think the way to speak to these owners is financially. Now, with that being said, it's interesting because, you know, you go team by team and market by market, you will get some very different perspectives, right? Because for the Baltimore Orioles, missing the first week of baseball is almost inconsequential. Like, it almost doesn't matter. And yet, for the Blue Jays, and we haven't heard from Blue Jays ownership, Ed Rogers, anyone else on this, but for the Blue Jays, missing these games is way worse. You have to imagine the Blue Jays want to be playing baseball and want to be having this incredible team on the field. So even within the ownership group, there are very different divergent interests and motivations.
On the Blue Jays side, Ben, I have two questions that flow from the piece you co-reported with Shai yesterday at sportsnet.ca. The first is, how do you and Shai determine who gets the little headshot on a co-bylined article? Because we see Shai Davidi and Ben Nicholson-Smith, but it's Shai's face. The other is, what is Rogers' take on this? You guys have some reporting in that piece, and, you know, obviously Rogers owns Sportsnet, and that's a factor for reporting, but it's also, you guys go through a 41-page release from January that includes a line about Rogers anticipating no sports-related work stoppages or cancellations. That's a real factor in how this company and how this team has been moving forward. So what is the Jays and Rogers impact here?
Yeah, to start with the headshots, I have no idea. That is beyond me. I'll do my best to answer the second question. I think that, you know, when you look at, again, the importance of the Toronto Blue Jays, a very exciting team, a very exciting team for Sportsnet. I know that at Sportsnet, we're excited to broadcast this team. I think that is a fact. The Blue Jays are a really exciting team. on the rise. I know there's excitement at Sportsnet about that. Now, you look within the Toronto Blue Jays, okay? Ross Atkins, the coaching staff, Mark Shapiro, they're not just saying they're excited. They are actually excited about what this team can do. And, of course, there are revenue implications for that, and Mark Shapiro, being the president of this team, oversees the business aspects. Of course, the business group is excited about this team, and the baseball side is excited about this team. So I don't know. Of course, there are longer-term considerations here, and Mark Shapiro has, you know, worked on league committees. He's certainly close with people at Major League Baseball. But at the same time, for the Toronto Blue Jays, and this is part speculation and, again, part, you know, looking at that report and kind of the assumptions that there would be a season, you've got to imagine that compared to most teams in baseball, the Blue Jays stand to lose more. And this is a team that would benefit by being on the stage and by having the chance to play baseball games.
So, Ben, you end that piece that you had with Shai with a quote from Ross Stripling that I think sums up all of our feelings over the last week, which is Monday, man, it didn't look like we were close, and all of a sudden we were kind of close. We weren't that close, but we were kind of close, and that's kind of how all of this has felt. Are we at a point now, like in terms of next steps, and kudos to you for how great your reporting has been throughout this cycle. In your reporting, your conversations, are we headed for a period where we take a step back now and the sides are going to go on their own and kind of regroup? I know there was reporting the next meetings will be in New York, not in Jupiter. I guess basically, are we bringing you on daily now to give us the CBA update, or are we taking a pause and we'll revisit
43
this?
Forty-three more days.
Yeah, what's the next step timeline-wise?
Yeah, logistically, there are some flights and some people have to get to different places, so you have to imagine talks slow down at least for a day or two. Ultimately, these sides need each other. There's no question there. So I don't know what the cadence looks like. It was interesting listening to Rob Manfred yesterday, and when asked what the next step is, he hinted that he believes it's on the players to come to the league with their next proposal. So, you know, I don't know what the pace is going to look like. And as anyone who's kind of followed my guesswork on this would know, I've been wrong many times already about when I think the talks are going to pick up. And so it's really tough to predict anytime you have 1,200 players, 30 owners, a lot of variables there, but certainly hope for the players and the fans, that we get to watch baseball soon. And for that to happen, these negotiations do have to pick up sometime before too long.
Before we let you go, Ben, will you ballpark how many swing tips Rob Manfred has fielded over the last 14 to 16 hours?
I have no idea. I hope that he's focused on something other than his golf swing. I hope that he's focused on really trying to understand where the player's at. And, you know, comments like, you know, a piece of metal for the World Series trophy, comments like, you know, the ones he was making yesterday with a smile on his face, it suggests that he is not reading the room with the players. And it is very important that he be able to do that for these talks to gain some real momentum. So the golf swing, I mean, I hope if he's getting those text messages that he's not answering them and he is directing his energy elsewhere.
Yeah, no, he's doing great. He's really great. We all love him. What a lovable guy. What an amazing human being. His ability to read a room. I don't think he's trying, Ben, and I don't think he's going to try. I don't think that's ever going to happen with that dude. Ben Nicholson-Smith, again, your reporting throughout this has been incredible. Thanks for all the work, and thanks for coming on this morning, man.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
It's our MLB editor and co-host of the At the Letters podcast, the guy who's very connected, who works the phone lines like nobody's business. Yeah, I got to tell you, the only positive out of this entire experience has been Ben, you know, just continuing to flourish as a reporter, because he's an awesome guy and he works unbelievably hard, and he is just totally like the gold standard, I think anyways, at our work in terms of like what you would want to be. So he did mention something there that I think is kind of the awkward piece in all this. He's right, we work for a company where it's like they're the owners. They're one of the owners. And think that we've been pretty unabashed in terms of our criticism of the owners, and so they fall underneath that category. But I will say that it's interesting hearing Ben say that, and interesting pointing out that piece of the report from our vantage point anyways, because I got to imagine that the Blue Jays don't just stand to lose some of them, that they stand to lose the most, that they are the most, like, when our team is hot, the gate changes. The Rogers Center is a huge baseball venue. Massive. I think people don't really realize how many seats there are in the Rogers Center compared to other baseball parks until they go to other ones and go, wait, this is all the seats you have? It's like, yeah. What about all the rest? No, that's the Rogers Center. It's a massive, massive, massive concrete, I don't know, ugly thing, but it's our ugly thing. It is a huge driver for summer programming for Sportsnet. It's this massive thing where they're trying to get done all these extra renovations. Like, they're trying to capitalize on this moment. Shapiro, Atkins, the company, like, there are a lot of things in motion with the Blue Jays being hot. And if you want to talk about, like, pandemic and trying to get back into the black and doing all these different things, like, the Blue Jays are unbelievably important for that, for this company. Like, really, really, really important for that. Yeah, grand scheme of things, over the course of the entire Rogers company, it's been pretty well established because they do still sometimes get looked at as just a property that you can sell, right? You get that all the time, the rumors that, oh, the Rogers are going to sell the Blue Jays because they view it as this, or it's an asset and blah, 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 blah. But from this standpoint, from, like, the actual, out of the, like, you need 23 owners to sign off on this thing, right? I would just guess that would be, I don't know. What Ben just pointed out there at least gives me a little bit of comfort. I don't know. Maybe I'm just fooling myself again. I have no idea.
So it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
And yum, yum, yum.
Come on. So, yeah, obviously there's a lot to chew on from this entire situation, from that interview with Ben. But I do think the thing here is, like, look, I again, like we've talked about and just mentioned with Ben and like you just laid out, we do work for a company that owns the baseball team. And maybe this is also a little guilty of, oh, we're the center of the universe all the time. But I really do think the Blue Jays stand to lose more from a baseball perspective and an economic perspective.
They, like, lose, sure, most everywhere.
The Yankees and Dodgers probably pull in so much money hand over fist that, like, in raw dollars, they might be the biggest losers. But in terms of big picture, like what the next 3 to 5 years look like economically, competitively, the effect that a rapid fire shortened off season is going to have whenever we get going again, it's hard not to feel like the Jays are one of the teams that this affects the most and the worst. And obviously the three of us individually we're the biggest victims of all of this. But the something that you on here is, like, yeah, this is, it's not uniform how this affects each team and each ownership group and each roster and each little baseball economy. And the Jays are in a tough spot. It's this sucks. Chew on that. This sucks. Chew on it for the next 43 days or whatever.
It sure does. So, you know what didn't suck, though? That Raptors game last night. Shockingly, yeah. So. Let's talk about it. Was it right to boo Goran Dragic? Was it fun to boo Goran Dragic? Maybe they're two separate answers. It's the Fan Morning Show. JD, Justin, and Blake. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I'm JD Bunkus, Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert with us. Rock legends Motley Crue and Def Leppard are coming to Toronto, and we want to send you. We're giving away tickets all week long to their August 8th show at the Rogers Center. If you want to win a pair of tickets, be caller number 5 right now at 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, or *590. If you're not caller number 5, you can tune in tomorrow for your next chance to win. All week, Motley Crue and Def Leppard. So, talking about, you know, rocking arenas. That was the Raptors yesterday. That was the one nice thing about yesterday, was fans back doing things. Full house, felt good. I loved the energy of the arena last night. I thought that Raptors fans, listen, I'm biased. I'm always going to be biased. But I do think there's like an excitement level that Raptors fans get that is different than a lot of places around the NBA. People just love this team. The people who go to Raptors games are just so emotionally invested in them that it's there is a more familial feel to the Raptors than anything else. I swear. There just is. It's more, it's just different. It's a different vibe. It's a different crowd. It's a different atmosphere. And does that result in the odd time where, you know, you're playing the Charlotte Hornets on a Tuesday and people act like it's an NBA playoff game? Sure. Is it cringy sometimes? A little bit. But is it awesome? Absolutely it is. And I thought that was kind of the way I felt about it last night. Really raucous crowd. I'll just kind of ask you guys. It was weird, Blake. You're right. Because it, you couldn't help but think about missing a home opener as you were watching the Raptors fill the crowd. But just how did you guys feel yesterday seeing the full arena before we even get into the basketball stuff?
I thought it was cool. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm talking to friends who are going to the game and the excitement level there from them in those conversations. It's great. And you see it on Twitter, people posting that they're back there or whatever, and free t-shirts. There's nothing the city loves like a free t-shirt. It was cool. And I thought, you know, I do think that the steam got taken out of it a little bit for me personally because, and look, this is a very privileged stance where I've been to so many Raptors games and I go regularly as media that the crowd being back full is cool. It makes those games a bigger deal and feel like a big thing. But it doesn't move the needle for me quite as much a March game against a bad Brooklyn team as, say, the Blue Jays home opener would have. So the biggest thing for me, honestly, and this really manifested itself in the fourth quarter as the Raptors are coming back and that game gets really tight, is, oh, yeah, this is an advantage come playoff time when the games really matter. And I couldn't help but thinking how, like, we've never had in basketball the equivalent of a wild card game. And, man, if the Raptors host a play-in game and it's one and you're in or you go home, that place is going to be nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I have sort of the same experience as you, Blake, in that gone to a lot of Leaf games, sat in the press box a lot over the last 3-4 years. And you, it gets to the point where, like, the same video montage, the same Arkells song behind the same video, like, it gets a little bit, you know, it bugs you a little bit. Like, you get a little bit jaded in that position. But as someone who's been to lots of Leaf games, I'm inherently jealous about the vibe and the atmosphere that the Raptors can summon. Like, you're right, JD. Like, they have something truly special at Raps games. The crowd is so into it and adds to the experience. I mean, we're going to see the Leafs invite fans back very, very soon tonight. But, yeah,
and listen, it is good going to a Leafs game, but you're right.
Great.
It's just like there's
it's
a party
great.
Feel to the Raptors that's like, I don't know, it's just different.
It's a party feel, and it translates so well to television, too. I mean, you get up close and personal looks at these fans who look so different or so excited to be there. Like, it just adds so much to the Raptors, more so than, you know, not every other team. The Jays, when the Jays have it, it's amazing as well. But there is something really special about Raptors and their connection to fans. And of course, that is underscored when they can actually get into the building.
Yeah, and I really thought you saw that yesterday. It was really fun, and it was very enjoyable. And I'll admit I was very sick yesterday, and I was kind of watching this through a fever haze. And it felt a little bit like a bit of a fever dream watching an arena like that and remembering that, hey, this is Canada. Because I watch so many sports. All these other arenas are full. You kind of had to take a second to go, oh, right, it's different here. Oh, right, we have been the place that has the empty arenas. We have had the place where they stupidly let in, like, what, 500 fans to go to Raptors games? I still don't understand. The season ticket holders, they have to sit around there, 500 people. It's just outrageous, some of the policies of this place. But, yeah, it was entertaining. And you got that, too, with – I was debating with people. I was surprised that it was a bit of a debate maybe, but I don't know. Bring it up here. I love that they booed Dragic. I think that sports hate is awesome. Dragic came to the city and said he had higher aspirations immediately, and now he's playing for a team that, sure, has better title chances because they're going to get Kevin Durant back. I'm not going to delude myself into saying that they don't, but they are below the Raptors in the standings right now. It's not exactly like the Brooklyn Nets or some kind of wonderful franchise that, you know, you grow up dreaming to play for the Brooklyn Nets. Goran Dragic watched Kerry Kittles. He's growing up. I want to be Kerry Kittles someday. I liked it. I was surprised. Some people said that it was beneath Raptors fans, or that it was cringy because he had so little of a time. I don't know. I thought it was great. I didn't think that it was over the top. It's not like people brought out the Kevin Durant cupcake signs and made a whole show of it and really went after him. But I thought that just booing the guy when he touches the ball that didn't want to be in your city was appropriate.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. I mean, it's something where I don't want to police fandom. So if you didn't boo, cool. If you booed, cool. I'm always, for star players,
I'll
yes,
police
boo.
Fandom.
I'm always, pardon?
I said, I'll police the fandom. Yeah, I'll be the fandom.
I'm always of the mind with lower-end players like this that the harshest thing you can do is not care at all. Like, you were so meaningless to us. But I get it. And, like, look, Dragic had a good game, too. He was fueling some good Brooklyn runs. And he was, I thought, playing into it a little bit, right? Like, yeah. He knew. He knows
yep.
the game.
Yeah.
It makes – and maybe it was a little different because it was the first game with fans back, so – that was supposed to carry it. But like, if this is a random game and it's their seventh game back at home, like, it's just a funny aside of like, well, look at the crowd and Goran going back and forth a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you said before the break, JD, were they right to boo Goran Dragic? I thought, were they wise to boo Goran Dragic? I mean, I felt like it kind of spurred a little bit in the Nets in that I think Dragic responded to it well, and I think his teammates sort of picked up on him responding to it, and of course, they heard the boos. But to go back to the original point, I mean, to suggest that Raptors fans are lesser than because they are booing a player, just I don't care what role he plays on the Brooklyn Nets, he offended Raptors fans.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They are responding to being offended by the fact that he didn't want to be here, and the way he acted. Like, again, I don't know exactly what happened and behind the scenes here with Dragic, but he didn't want to play for the Raptors. He didn't want to be in the city. He didn't want to be a part of this organization. So any good fan, any fan that is knowledgeable and passionate and into it, would have a response to it. So to suggest that Raptors fans were lesser than in any way, I mean, they're showing their fandom and how genuine it is by reacting the way they did.
Yeah, I loved it. And even when Blake says he's a lesser player, I go, not really, though, because it's one thing if this dude is has never had a moment in the league, but it's Goran Dragic. He's had, what, a 12 to 15-year career at this point of being 10 of those.
He was an All-NBA guy.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And not only that, this has always been under-discussed with the Dragic thing to me, and maybe it's just because I'm... maybe this speaks to me more than anything, but I've always hated Dragic as a Raptors guy. Like, he got into it with DeMar. They played him in a big playoff series that was the coming out party for Kyle Lowry. He's always been a rat. Like, always. The NBA doesn't have a lot of rats. It doesn't. It's not a rat league. It's not a league where there's a billion guys who try to get under your skin that way. Like, he's sneakily closer to a Patrick Beverly than I think people realize. He's annoying. He's awful to play against. And he was sort of the Miami Heat's version of a Kyle Lowry. Obviously a much lesser version of that, but he was kind of their culture guy, annoying, bitching at the refs constantly, just kind of in your face, doing just things that are clearly annoying. Again, like, who gets into it with DeMar DeRozan? If we did a NBA popularity rankings amongst the league of guys that are respected amongst their peers, I really do believe that it would come back unanimous. Everyone loves DeRozan, except maybe one guy who's Goran Dragic who mixes it up with him. Like, I don't even think Patrick Beverly mixes up with DeRozan. They all respect DeMar DeRozan, as Vince Staples says.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know the Simpsons meme of don't make me tap the sign? Don't make me press play on the Vince Staples soundbite.
It's outrageous. I've always hated Goran Dragic. I've never wanted him to be a Toronto Raptor. He showed up here and said that he had higher aspirations. And my read on the situation is that this is very obvious. He said he had higher aspirations. He didn't want to be here. They looked at moving him during the offseason. There was no value for him. He came to the team. They thought, okay, maybe. And then they saw a guy who was pouty and sulky who didn't want to play for the Raptors. And they said, well, we're better off trying out our young guys than putting a half-hearted, half-invested Goran Dragic on the floor, who's probably just going to either stat chase or coast. So they sent him home, and then they let him, because this organization is 100% all the way class, get to put it as, oh, it's a family thing. Oh, Dragic is out there. We're not going to put any heat on him whatsoever because we don't need to do that. And then, you know, he goes to the Nets in what essentially turned out to be, I guess I could kind of get to the Thad Young thing in a second, but a questionable Dragic trade, I would say. So, double questionable. One questionable, the other. I have a follow-up on the Dragic trade, by the way, for you, Blake, after this. But yeah, finish the thought.
So, I do wonder if the Dragic trade is... Or, sorry, not trade, but the Dragic era in Toronto is looked at a little differently.
The Dragic era.
Yeah. I can't wait
to refer to that.
All 40 points.
The Dragic, I'm going to use that against Blake all the time now. I'll be like, 4 years from now, I'm going to text Blake, like, what's your favorite memory from the Dragic era?
Still his era. Yeah. So I do wonder if, like, I think Raptors fans are smart enough to, even if they're being emotional to this or didn't like the guy or whatever, like, they know the score. They knew why, for the most part, sure, why this was happening. I think a big part of how Raptors fans digested the Dragic situation, though, was that the intention with pulling from the rotation was to give minutes to young guys like Delano Banton and Malachi Flynn. And those Banton was in the rotation for a minute, and then he wasn't. And then they were playing nobody as the backup point guard, and Fred was leading the league in minutes. And Dragic's absence, first of all, his absence loomed larger because you needed point guard depth. And there was a incongruity between why Dragic was away from the team, which was in part because the team's not going to use him, and what was actually happening, which was, oh, you're not playing the young point guards anyway. I do wonder if everyone feels differently about it and cares way less if this entire time Malachi Flynn is playing regular minutes and he doesn't need to look as good as he looked these last two games where he's been one of the best players on the floor for the Raptors. But if he's playing this whole time and looking competent, I think everyone's like, yeah, of course, this makes perfect sense. It's just a delayed payoff here, I guess.
Hey, so before we move to Malachi, because I do want to talk about Malachi, I want to talk about Malachi and Scottie Barnes. I just want to ask you a question that I thought of last night, because, okay, I actually thought Thad Young played well again, and it was funny because he played like 6 minutes for the first 3.5 quarters, and I went, is he hurt? What's happening with Thad Young? The deployment of Thad has been weird. I'm just going to say that. It's been a weird deployment for a guy who, in his minutes over his last three games, has looked pretty effective to me and is a sort of natural fit to just eat a lot of the OG Anunoby role. Like, that's part of the reason why you go out and get 6'9 interchangeable guys, to me, would be that if you lose one of the 6'9 guys, you plug and play the other 6'9 defensive guy who can knock down a corner three. Anyway, I did think about, though, reflecting on the Dragic thing yesterday of, okay, so my hope is that this ends up being all right. The Raptors sacrifice a pick that, you know, they win a play-in game somehow, or maybe if, I don't know, what was the update on Jaylen Brown yesterday? Was he actually really hurt, or did he, was he done?
I don't think he came back. I don't know if we have an update.
If Jaylen Brown's seriously hurt,
calling it. Sorry.
Okay, well, I was going to say, if he's seriously hurt and he has to miss a lot of time, then maybe Boston does slip down the standings, and maybe the Raptors could catch them and get all the way up to that six seed. The hope that you have, if you're a Raptors fan, is that they forked that pick over that they traded for Thad Young this year, and it's because they didn't love this draft and they feel like it's deep and there's a lot of interchangeable guys between like the 17 to 30 range and they can find good value there. Plus, they view Thad Young as a guy that could not only help right now, but also maybe they end up re-signing on a friendlier contract or that he might be amenable to being a Raptors player next year and fits with the culture and does all those things. Okay, fine. But the thought did cross my mind of they had to trade Dragic. They had to move Dragic for something because it would have been a horrific look on the front office to just buy him out after all of this, right? For them to just buy him out would have been really tough for Masai and Bobby, and I do think they would have taken a little bit of a flack for it. I guess my question to you, Blake, is there part of you that looks at that trade? Because I still think it's an overpay for Thad. I do. I'm sorry. I think it's an overpay for a guy that was on the Spurs playing no minutes that had zero part of... Like, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that Thad Young would have got bought out by San Antonio, had no one move for him. Like, I think it's possible. Did the Raptors maybe get a little... I don't want to say shanghaied, but, like, did they potentially get a little overzealous with that trade because they knew they had to move Goran Dragic? Like, is there no part of you that maybe doesn't believe that they go, well, we can't just buy him out, so even if it means sacrificing these 15 draft picks or moving down whatever range, that we have to do this because we can't buy him out because the optics of it are horrific? And I hate when that plays into things, optics playing into a move.
I don't think they care that much about the optics because, I mean, look, they would have handled the Dragic situation a lot better from a PR standpoint. They've liked Thad Young forever. Like, I've heard them talk about Thad Young, and he's been in Raptors rumors since, like, I don't know, 2013 or something like that. Like, they've always liked this guy. They really like him still. And the honest truth is, we can obviously disagree on this with them, but they really, like, we talked to Bobby on the show, Bobby Webster, and they're pretty steadfast that, like, they think the group of guys they're picking through at number 18, say, they're going to get one of those guys at 32 in a draft like this. So they don't see the asset cost as high as you do. I still think the real missed opportunity, and what I was licking my chops about when they had the Dragic deal entering the deadline season, was I think you could have, rather than do a small asset downgrade, sliding from a mid-first to a early second to get that, I still think there probably would have been opportunity to just, like, use Dragic and assets to add a more meaningful piece. Having said that, I think Thad's looked great. I think, you know, he's averaging 19 minutes a game since he got here. You obviously see what he could bring and the role he could play. Yeah, it's been a little weird finding his spots. And he's always going to be a weird guy because, like, they're going to want to play him with some younger guys to help bring their level of play up. But he's going to look at his best with the starters because he's the dot connector type. I think the honest answer is, yeah, they didn't handle the Dragic situation as well as they could have from an optics standpoint. And they disagree about the relative value drop from, say, 18 to 32 in the draft.
But that part doesn't scare me as much as the idea that the pick could roll over, right? Like, that's been my main assertion the entire time. If you can't get out of the play-in game, if you lose that play-in game and you end up in the lottery, then I would say that it is a pretty significant asset cost to get that young to be rolling a pick over into the following year.
Yeah. Opportunity cost of not having that pick that you can then move, right?
Exactly. Like, it's just a huge risk factor.
Yeah. Although let's not think like this negatively. If they miss the playoffs next year, then the pick just becomes a pair of seconds.
Yeah, I know, but it's like
you're cooking. Yeah.
The only way that you miss the playoffs next year, I thought about
this
actually.
If so.
Well, it's not only a disaster, but I actually think that considering how strong next year's draft class is, I actually wondered, you know, if you're the Raptors, you lose a play-in game and you're fully healthy, how much that evaluation goes into, like, what your future plans are. You know, you pick in the lottery this year, you end up with another pick. And we've talked about timelines with this team multiple times where we go, hey, what is the impetus? Is it to build around Fred and Siakam? Or is it to be a little bit more towards how long is it going to take Scottie Barnes to be this team's best player? And I got to tell you, if the potential of losing a first-round pick next year is on the table, I would have to think that at least plays some consideration into these things.
What I've come to appreciate about Thad Young and, like, thinking about the value that he brings, because you're right, I think, like, there's reason to question certain elements of the move, is, you know, in these last two games, I found that, I'm curious what you guys think about this, is that he's very aware and picks up on who's going, and he does whatever he can help facilitate that player. Like, I think that is a good thing from a developmental standpoint, in that he can pick up on, oh, Scottie Barnes is going. How can I make life even easier on him right now so we can maximize this moment? And I don't know how much that means to this season and prospects of having success in the postseason this spring. But from a developmental standpoint and maybe looking to the future, that facilitative element of his game, I think there is a lot of value there.
I just don't think that you overpay in draft pick capital that. Like, I think that draft capital for a team like the Raptors is paramount. They're not signing free agents. They have a lot of competitive disadvantages. And even if Bobby Webster tells me that they value the 30th pick closer to the 18th pick, I can tell you something with very much certainty, is, like, there's a far greater chance of a good player being at 18 than there is at 32. Like, it's followed the league for a long time. I've heard of a lot of bad drafts. Haven't had a lot of times where I've said to myself, you know what, I wish that we had the 32nd pick instead of the 18th pick. That'd be good. And even there are also scenarios where really good players slide, like OG Anunoby, and had the Raptors had the 18th overall pick in the OG draft, they draft them. And if they have the 32nd overall pick in the OG draft, guess who's not on this team right now? Mr. OG Anunoby. So, yeah, I guess I fundamentally disagree with some things, but I don't even know if that's true, Blake, but that's just why I wanted to raise it with you. But yeah, let's talk about Flynn and Scotty here quickly, because Flynn, the hesitation move at the beginning of the game was like, oh, that was sexy.
LaMarcus then, Aldridge is still stuck at Scotiabank Arena right now.
I was going to say,
frozen.
It did help that that was basically the chair Yi Zhiliang went up against on defense, like where it was just completely frozen in space. But yeah, it was an awesome play, but I was really impressed with the playmaking. Like, I just thought, hey, one, obviously he's a good pick-and-roll player. Like, that's just painfully obvious that he is an NBA-level guy in the pick-and-roll, which is, you know, the thing that matters the most.
Who would have guessed the best pick-and-roll point guard in college 2 years ago is capable in the pick-and-roll in the NBA?
But I was kind of surprised at the level of his court vision yesterday. That was a little piece from Malachi Flynn that we got a preview of that I was not particularly aware of before.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about it a lot yesterday in terms of role certainty and what are you being asked to do and what is your comfort level. And I think we're seeing that, right? Like, he's not going to play 43 minutes a game when Fred's back, but this is a couple game stretch. And I mentioned the stat yesterday of this was his first stretch of three games with double digit minutes since very, very early in the season. And it only happened last year once they were in kind of tank mode. And look, I think a reasonable person could look at Malachi's first 2 years in the league and be a little less optimistic now than they were at the start because of the fits and spurts, because of just, you know, some of the limitations there. But I don't think anyone could look at his last 2 months of last season, which, again, were garbage time and the team was not invested in winning. Sure, but that's not true of their opponents. And if you're a point guard, having good players play with you is helpful. So you could almost argue a rookie point guard having to play with Aaron Baines and stuff is not helping his cause. So anyway, between this stretch
really?
Last year, the little burst
playing
he's
with
shown,
the corpse of Aaron Baines, not good for you basketball wise. Blake Murphy, this is why they pay you the big bucks.
So I think that even if you've lost some of the shine on Malachi of, oh, he's a first round pick, he's, you know, maybe the answer at backup point guard long term. I don't know how you watch this guy right now and be like, oh, he's not an NBA rotation player. He clearly is and probably has been the whole time. He just needed this little bit of whether it's confidence or leash or room to make mistakes, whatever. He's an NBA rotation player.
What I'll remember from the Goran Dragic era is that they had a backup point guard and they just didn't choose to play him. You're right, JD. I mean, when I look back at last night's game, like thinking about it this morning, the play I remember, Scotty Barnes hitting that sort of desperation jumper. But second to that, and late in the game, Malachi running the floor and I think hitting Thad Young in the corner for a three ball. I feel like that was one of the pivotal moments of the game, an example of what he does really, really well to not give this guy run. We've said it a million times just being on the show the last 3 days, and I'm sure you guys have talked about it a lot. But it doesn't make sense why he isn't getting run. And I think one of the silver linings here with Fred being out, obviously you get more Malachi, and this has really been a proving ground that he's taken full advantage of.
Yeah, there's so many layers to the Malachi Flynn thing that are frustrating and difficult to process. And because, when they first traded for Dragic, part of my frustration was, why are you trading for this guy? You need to play Flynn. And then they go, we're sending Goran Dragic home. I'm like, good, because you need to play Flynn. And then they didn't play Flynn. And, I thought about, if I'm Nick Nurse, I don't necessarily need to be embarrassed because I can sell this as, I benched him all year because I thought he always had this within him and he just needed the reality check. But that's not true. Fred got hurt. You know, like, you didn't start inserting him into basketball games. And so your point guard is hurt in part, potentially. I guess I can't play, like, the exact part of this, but it's the reason you don't have Fred VanVleet last night is because maybe you didn't play Malachi Flynn enough. And now the upside of potentially the VanVleet injury is that you have Malachi Flynn and he's showing you that he can play. Like, I don't know, man. There's like a million things that seem like they were mistakes with Malachi Flynn. The only one of them that I think is a saving grace is that they didn't end up doing what Blake calls a challenge trade, where they just flipped Malachi Flynn for some kind of crappy big man at the deadline and then had Fred go down, and all of a sudden we're watching Delano Banton try to run this offense over 36 minutes a night. I think that would kind of suck. And I like Delano, but yeah, let's be honest. He can't play like Malachi Flynn can play. Like, my God, they're worlds apart in terms of their NBA abilities right now.
And Delano's supposed to be with the 905 anyway. This was supposed to be the plan. And Malachi,
Well, Malachi's not even really a rookie. He's like 34 years old. So he's basically fits the timeline of Fred and Siakam more than he does Scotty.
Yeah, exactly. He's got the Boucher age to him. All right. there's going to be lots of time to talk more about Malachi Flynn, because I think he's in the rotation until he's not now.